welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Mondays. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy, we were talking about and are still talking about Ukraine and what's happening. And this thing is just, I mean, as early as it is, what is this, the third month?
Yeah. Third month.
Third month. And you know, been a lot of action.
Well, actually, it's the second month. It's not, wow. It's not 90 days, it's 60. Yeah. But, you know, and the thing about it is Ukraine is such a complex situation. I mean, the American public probably has no knowledge of who Yanukovych was. He was the leader before Zelensky.
No, I mean, I don't know who he was.
And how did Yanukovych get unseated? He was essentially the sitting president, and he was deprived of his position, much like being impeached. And how did that happen, and what was the process?
Did we have any involvement?
Well, there was definitely some kind of street involvement, and there would be those who allege that there were a great deal of foreign interest and foreign involvement, foreign money, foreign cooperation with those who were dissidents, and he was elected in a tightly contested election. It was a contested election in which there were recounts, and so there were not great allegations of fraud associated with the ultimate outcome, and yet he was unseated and replaced then by Zelensky. And Zelensky was a pro-nationalist, pro-Western guy. Yanukovych was a pro-Russian person. Most of the governments of Ukraine up to that point had been pro-Russian, had been. Ukraine was very intertwined with Russia. The economies were very intertwined. They were very intertwined culturally. The notion that they would be a country that would lean towards Russia is not at all surprising. Although there were a lot of nationalistically hard feelings historically between. Particularly the Western Ukrainians and Russia. And Yanukovych was from the east. He was from Donetsk and was from the east of Ukraine. But it's a very complex situation, which we have simplified and are now ignoring all of the complications of it in the process we're going through.
You know, Sandy, having said that, I didn't know anything about that, but I know the history of our nation. And it would not surprise me one bit if, you know, we haven't had some involvement in some way, be it monetary or whatever. That's what we've done. As you talk about our foreign involvement in nations, there's a reason why we've got bases all over the world, right? I mean,
oh yeah, and I think there's a great deal of. Yeah, there's a lot of literature out there now describing the nature of the involvement of the United States in that whole Yanukovych unseating, the ambassador at that point, I think a woman named Nuland, who was the ambassador to Ukraine, and the involvement of our State Department, and undoubtedly our CIA was involved in meddling in the process, because we were very interested in having a westward-leaning Ukraine rather than an eastern-leaning Ukraine.
Sandy, that's our MO all over the world. So it would not surprise me if that was what happened there. Who do we have on the line, Sam?
CJ's calling back.
All right, CJ, what's going on, man?
Hey, thanks for taking my call, both to you, Earl, and Sandy on Mondays.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, you talk about Ukraine, and it actually took Ukraine for the Democrats to care about our border. Oh, yeah, they don't. 3.3 million across. And Paris.
Hey, Sandy, hold on. I mean, CJ, hang on a second, man. Is hard for you to inculcate anything other than that? Have you heard what Sandy and I are talking about at all? Have you listened to
it? I have.
So how do you get from there to the border? I just Can't you respond to any of what we just were talking about, which to me is much bigger, CJ, than the border could ever be?
Oh, really? So terrorists, so it doesn't matter to you that they've crossed. But, you know, I guess what does matter to me is this never should have happened and it wouldn't have happened. But
I know if Donald Trump was president.
Okay. Putin watched. You don't believe it, Earl, but Putin watched Afghanistan, the surrender of Afghanistan. And your candidate, Biden campaigned. He was the only guy.
You're a one-hit wonder, CJ.
Wait a minute. See, I want to hear what you were saying. He was the only guy. Biden was the only guy what to talk
he
about?
Campaigned.
About pulling out of Afghanistan?
Joe Biden as the candidate was the only guy that could go toe-to-toe with Putin. Do you recall that?
Well, I guess maybe he did go toe to toe. Maybe this is the result.
Well, yeah, he sure did. As he watched him build 250,000 troops on the border, and then he says, "Yeah, his whole staff and administration."
Well, and actually, that 250 CJ
were meant to deter. These sanctions were meant to deter, and then what does Biden say? He said, "Oh no, they were never meant to deter." This guy is a failure. He is going to get us into World War III, and he is a commander cut and run, and he's a disaster. Just the way you guys don't care about our southern border, that's fine. Vice President Harris is taking care of it. Yeah, she's doing a great job. So you guys can just, you know, dance around that Joe's doing this thing, keeping NATO together and all this stuff. Well, finally, the countries in NATO are paying their fair share thanks to Donald Trump.
CJ, did you get it off your chest before we let Sandy respond? Is it all out now?
Well, actually, CJ, I would respond, CJ, but those are the exact three things that you've said for the last three calls. So
they're still,
they're the issues you have.
You don't care that Biden's getting us into World War III. You don't care that he's getting us into World War III.
Have you been listening, CJ, to Sandy and I? We've been talking about what is going on, and we know that it's not just because of Biden.
That's the sad fact. This didn't happen before Biden.
Sandy,
this is Biden's war.
Okay. Well, if you think that things like this happen because of a spontaneous result. Do you know what happened to Russia when Russia withdrew from Afghanistan? Do you know what the Russian withdrawal from Afghanistan looked like? What kind of losses they sustained during the process?
I don't care.
Why don't you care?
I care that we left Americans and allies behind, Sandy. I don't care what Russia did.
We talked about this before. What about what we did in Syria with the Kurds? Donald Trump did
there
that.
There you go. Oh. I don't care.
You don't care about that.
Well, that's what we're doing now, Sandy.
No, you care now. Okay.
All right, CJ.
You guys dance. You do a fine dance together, but you don't face the facts of right now. This is Biden's war. This is Biden's administration.
Well, what did Biden do to create this war?
Well, he's got a theory. It's Afghanistan.
you think it was okay the way we left Afghanistan? Well, Trump wanted to go to zero in Afghanistan, and he didn't because he listened to his military.
Okay, I can't take it anymore. Okay. Thank you very much for the call.
Okay.
We tried. And you know, Sandy.
The only thing I'm not certain of is whether CJ calls each time or whether it's a loop recording. Because it is exactly the same conversation each time. And, you know, we've had it. I'm not sure it's worth repeating. I think clearly each of our presidents in my book, has made mistakes in their foreign affairs. And actually, the whole Yanukovych thing happened on Obama's watch. And there's some questions about how the U.S. government handled it then. And my problem with foreign affairs is that I'm not sure how much our presidents have to do with it. And it has a lot more to do with sort of the institutions we have that formulate our foreign affairs, who are a combination, apparently, of our State Department, our CIA, and the lobbyists in Washington who exert influence.
You know, Sandy, that's the shadow government they talk about. And you're right, because to me, a president can only be a president for 8 years.
Right.
And he's gone.
Well, and he's a victim, or he's not a victim, but he's basically, his parameters of action are limited by the information and options that are provided to him or her for the purpose, and all of that information and the parameters of options are presented to them by the government, this institution of government that exists before and after them.
So you know, when as CJ, he always brings up Obama, and these other people bringing up Obama's been gone, but yet they still bring him up.
Well, CJ didn't bring him up. CJ only wanted to talk about Biden and Trump.
But many on the right want to still bring up Obama. But my point is, Obama, the Bushes, the Clintons, those people have been gone. And yet the things that create what we're talking about now
continue.
Yes.
And so my view is that all of those people were, in some respects, victims of this government process that they inherit when they get elected. Yeah. And you know, the psychosis of American foreign policy has existed for generations.
Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Mondays, so that means Mondays with Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy, I was asking you during the break about the United Nations. And, you know, even though the United Nations is in America and basically was founded in our country and remains in New York, and it's supposed to be a global nation,
mm-hmm.
you know, United Nation. And in many instances, it's voted against America, right?
Well, I mean, it's set up in a way that was designed to protect the major countries from being subjected to an international government. So the Security Council, the one that would act in the time of, for instance, keeping the peace and warfare, there's an absolute veto power on the part of each of the members of the Security Council. The Security Council are all the great nations of the world.
Yeah, Russia was on the Security Council.
Oh, yeah, still is. And so they can veto the conduct of the United Nations insofar as it relates to many of the things that the United Nations would be called upon to do. And there was an article this weekend I was reading, an internationally based article, talking about some of the things that could come out of the Ukrainian war, things that would end up losing status in the world. And the two of them that mentioned was the United Nations and the International Court of Justice. And in both cases, it's because they had to stand by impotently and were not unable to implement any of their powers in the context of what's going on in the world. So we have people shouting war crimes, but the International Court of Justice hardly ever really implements an analysis of that. It did after the Balkan conflict, when some of the leaders became common citizens, lost their power, and were subject to arrest. So yeah, there's been an analysis there. And the UN basically has demonstrated that it's good at dealing with malaria, mosquitoes, and things like that, but it's not too very good at dealing with world peace issues.
Well, number one, it doesn't have a military.
Well, and that we've had UN peacekeeping forces in certain circumstances in when there have been problems in the world, but it's never been a situation where there was a problem involving one of the members of the Security Council. So if the Security Council is involved, the UN is
hands
not.
Off.
Yeah, hands off.
So then, Sandy, how do we then, when we look at these things and we know that the United Nations is a paper tiger, and at some point, again, that's something else where we need to look at those things, right? And realize that, you know, it's not World War II anymore, right? That's past. That may have worked in World War II,
the notion of the UN came out of World War II, but it was essentially its ancestor was the League of Nations, which came out of World War I, and it was always this concept that if we could get everyone sitting in a room meeting together working on common problems, that there wouldn't be any more wars. And in each case, we found out that it doesn't. That isn't what happens from the United Nations. And so maybe people will just have to recalibrate their thinking about what the United Nations is there for and understand that it is to deal with international health problems and the like, but it's not there to deal with this important issue of world peace.
Sandy, the more you think about all of this, and these things just seem to be so far out of control of anybody other than he who has the might. I mean, that's he who has the gold rules. Those standards still
apply. Yep.
Yeah, no matter how hard we try to say that's changed, you know, you just look, open your eyes and see it. I don't care if it's in our country, if it's globally, it's the same thing. It's never changed.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the rest of the world likes to think of the United States in the context of conspiracies where somebody, some Wizard of Oz, is sitting behind a green curtain calling the shots and doing all of this. And no, it doesn't work quite like that. But there is a process that is behind a green curtain that we don't understand, we as the people don't understand so very clearly, that does seem to have a hand on the process. And it's not a single hand. It's the hand of, let's say, an industry, the industry that's related to our defense budget. There's a lot of industries that have an interest there, and they move and shape much of what we do that relates to our defense budget. And we have a whole group of people who are interested in international affairs from the standpoint of natural resources. And they have a lot to do with what our policies are. And it's not a person. It's a whole bunch of people. But it's a whole bunch of people who are not operating in bright sunlight. Okay? And so, we aren't really smart enough to have somebody thinking this all through, but we've got a whole bunch of people who are pushing our foreign policies in a direction that we as a people don't understand.
But don't other nations have people like that too? And it's leading me to believe that there's somebody from different other countries that sit on the top of all of it.
Well, each of the countries has something like what we've got. The smaller the country, the more possible it is that there would be a group of individuals who might have a great deal of say. In Saudi Arabia, it's the crown, crown prince. And in some countries, it's like in Russia, it's Vladimir Putin. But in a bunch of other countries, it's something more nebulous, right? It's interest groups that have a coincidence of interest together that push things. And that's pretty much, until Hitler became Hitler, that's pretty much what was pushing Germany in a direction. China does have a party structure with an individual in charge of the party, so there it's more of an individual. But, yeah, a lot of countries have something like what we have, which is shadow government interest groups.
So we don't want to think about, in many instances in our country, we don't want to even begin to think that that could possibly be true because, again, we still are under this illusion that, you know, one man, one vote, democracy is romantic, all of these things. But the more you think about it, Sandy, I remember when I was a younger person and I heard people talking like you and I are talking, I thought they were nuts.
Well, yeah, I sound like a communist.
Yeah.
But, you know, after Citizens United and after we decided that we would allow unlimited, essentially, money and interested money in government, we've probably instead of diluting this problem by in terms of limiting the problem, we've probably exacerbated the problem, made it more extreme by giving these interest groups greater capacity to control policy and control it in ways that are subtle, you know, to elect folks to office that will be sympathetic to their position. And most of those people elected don't even know that they're a party to this process. They're all doing something that feels right. They're protecting the employees for Raytheon in their state. They're protecting the employees to Oshkosh Truck in our state. They're doing these things that don't feel like they're complicit. But, you know, these companies, Oshkosh Truck is primarily a defense contractor.
You know, Sandy, I was reading something the other day about, and this is a little bit off the subject, about I forgot the stuff that they use to make the batteries for automobiles.
Lithium, yeah.
And nickel and all these other things, and the fact that they're plentiful, it's all over the world. It shouldn't be costing as much as it costs, but the cost of harvesting it, mm-hmm. and the way you go about doing it is what's at the root of it. And yet it's the expense that is being attributed to it, and only a handful of, we got to get a break. We'll talk about it when we come back from the break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back.
Talking about you, music people, it all depends on what you do. It ain't too bad the way you and me, cause I sure am you.
All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. Sandy Williams is here. It's always good to have me here. Sandy, you know, I was saying to you during the break that I got some guys who will call me and they'll say to me, you and Sandy are always talking about negative things about this country. And I got to tell you, one of the guys says, well, Sandy is always talking negative. I said, number one, you don't know anything about Sandy. And what Sandy is doing is in a position, and if anybody can talk about the greatness of the nation, you know, Sandy having graduated from Harvard and been able to be on high level discussions all over this nation, and at a time when you have sat down with many of the talking heads and had conversations. I don't think any of those people thought Sandy was an anti-American guy. How do people get to, if you're not willing to just go along with everything, that you're anti-American?
Well, I suspect, you know, because we're talking about things and I'm analyzing them, and I'm analyzing them hopefully in a way that I find to be truthful to what I think, at least, it might sound negative. But, I mean, you know, America's a great place, and it's been a great place for many, many, many people, and it's been a great place for many immigrants who've come here, and it's a great place when compared to many other places in the world. It's just not the greatest place in every respect, okay? And it's not...
And you've done some world traveling.
Well, yeah, but it... And you just have to look at data.
Yeah.
And it's also not as great as it could be. And it's not as great as Americans should hope it can be and will be. So how do we make it greater again? Well, we don't make it greater than it is now by simply congratulating ourselves on how great it is.
Let's make it better.
Well, we need to focus on how great we need to just take as a given. Yes, it's a great place, but how can it be greater? How can it be better? And without having a critique type discussion about what America is, we can't make it better. And so I keep coming back to that Toyota General Motors comparison that was in that article some 12 years ago, that basically demonstrated that a culture that only does self-congratulations slips backwards. And a culture which rewards and applauds a critical approach to getting better gets better. And if we don't start applauding a critical approach to America, in which all of it is viewed as constructive discussion on how to get better, well, we are going to get worse. And in fact, we have gotten worse. Many of our social issues have gotten worse because of the blinders, because of our heads in the sand. You would think we'd all be going to the eye doctor to get the sand out of our eyes, because we've all got our heads in the sand.
Who was that famous baseball player who said, never look back because something might be catching up to you, or something to that effect? I don't know who that person was, but he was absolutely right. We can't still live off the laurels of what America was, right? When you talk about what we were.
Even what we were wasn't as great as it could have been, obviously,
right.
And we've hopefully been in a situation of continual improvement, but is our continual improvement moving at a rate at which it could, and are there trends in our country that we ought to worry about because it's going to drag us down from being as great as we maybe are right now? And I would say that's the problem. You know, by ignoring and denying our capacity to get greater, by looking at the ways in which we might not be great, we actually are slipping.
You know, you go back, as you stated, how China is uplifting, and they've had to uplift, you know, hundreds of millions of people in this period of time, and educate hundreds of millions of people, and they've been able to do that and continue to do that. At the same time, we've been slipping, and you can't say that we haven't been slipping, because as you stated, when you look at us educationally and compare us to these other nations, we've been slipping. Well, that doesn't mean you're being critical of our nation for saying that we've been slipping, and that at some point in time, if we don't take that seriously, we're going to continue to slip, and we're going to continue to fall. May not happen in your or my lifetime, but it's inevitable, right?
Well, it is. You know, there's a discussion, there are many discussions psychologically and philosophically about wisdom, and wisdom tends to be defined as intelligence which knows its bounds, intelligence which understands what it doesn't know. And most of us get wiser as we get older, as we begin to realize all of our knowledge is not complete, and we don't know, and there's plenty of things we don't know and need to learn.
Right.
And that's really the same thing that is involved with the greatness of a nation. If we just decide that we are the greatest nation and need nothing, need do no self-analysis to figure out how we can get better, or if we decide that we aren't going to become a wise nation, understanding where we are good and where we aren't, well, then we aren't going to be a wise nation. And in fact, I think that there are many things that we're doing now that would indicate that wisdom is not one of our main traits.
So what I've never understood is, why do we, what do we get by telling the world we're the best? I mean, what is your, when by telling somebody you're the best, you're telling them that I'm better than you. And so what do you get out of that?
Well, I don't know. In the workplace I was in for a long time, I realized that self-promotion was a strategy that led to promotion. And in fact, you know, around our country, I do believe that personal breastfeeding, while it's obnoxious maybe culturally, seems to be a successful strategy for many people. And maybe we as a country have adopted this same sort of rough-hewn approach to announcing to the world our greatness and making ourselves believe it and hoping that the rest of the world does too. And there is enough great about us for lots of people to believe that we are great. I mean, one need only look around at the grandeur of what we have built in this country and to understand that this is the result of a greatness. The question is, How shared is the greatness? How great is the culture that we're developing? How well are we sharing the greatness amongst all of our people? How much are we fulfilling this concept of America? What ties Americans together is not our race. It's not our ethnicity. It's not our religion. It's the concept we have for America of a shared birthright towards opportunity. And I keep coming back to that, and that's why I keep coming back to the plight of our children, is how well are we sharing this birthright of equal opportunity in America?
You know, Sandy, I am not so naive that when I want to live somewhere else. I'm not unmindful of the fact that I can come in here 5 days a week and talk about this nation openly. Right? I haven't traveled the world to know that, to see it, but it doesn't mean I can't envision in my mind what is happening in other places. And so I'm not anti-American. I'll never be that. Right? I'm not so crazy. This is one of the greatest places to live on the face of the earth. But that doesn't mean it can't be better. And that's the way I look at it, right? I'm not going to sit still and be quiet and see things that aren't right and say, well, but, you know, it's the greatest nation on earth. Well, no, I mean, yeah, let's make it. And it's an open society that needs to be examined by the people in this society. And if somebody says something in the society to challenge it, then you can't just say, well, you know, you shouldn't be talking about that.
Well, interesting. I was just thinking as you were talking that one of the differences in the discourse between conservatives and liberals right now is that because we are criticizing these outcomes in America, the situation in America, we are called liberals. and we would be called conservatives if what we were attacking was the government. So conservatives attack the government of America, and liberals want to critique the outcomes in America that need to be addressed, they think, by changes in government. So it's kind of interesting. The tool of the liberal for changing the reality in America towards something better is typically to look towards the tools of government, because how else does an electorate accomplish something? And the conservatives want to attack the process of government to remove the tools that would otherwise be used by the liberals to try and change these situations. And I'm not sure that's exactly why we've set up this dichotomy, but it's an interesting fact that is the dichotomy in the dialogue.
But how are you ever going to overcome that? I mean, I don't, and I understand literally exactly what you're saying. But my thing is the silos get bigger and bigger. And so I don't think you're ever going to overcome that.
Well, we could overcome it if the conservatives and liberals would carry out a critique together to try and critique the situation in America as well as the vision of America. So if we adopted a unified vision, a shared birthright with equal opportunity, a broad vision, and then tried to look at that like you would in strategic planning and say, what's standing in the way of that and how do we solve those problems? You know, we might be able to talk about this in a way that wasn't just the conceptual notion of, you know, from the liberal standpoint as cast by the conservatives of expanding government. That's how the conservatives would accuse liberals of wanting to expand government and the reach of government into our personal lives. And the conservatives could stop thinking simply about destroying government in every respect because it is being used in this nefarious way to extend itself into personal lives. And if we really just started looking at problems and figuring out solutions, many of which might be solved through government's extension of government, and many of them might be solved in some other private capacity.
You know, Sandy, this, and I don't know, you know, if we're ever going to come to a point where that Democrat-Republican foolishness ever comes to an end. But, you know, it's just getting worse all along. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be back.
We got to work it out. We got to stop.
All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Mondays. That means Mondays with Sandy. You know, Sandy, we talk about some really serious subjects and conversations. It's why I thought, you know, 3 hours with you a week was not enough. It's why I increased it to 6 hours. And at times, I still don't think it's enough. As somebody who listens to, you know, the stuff that's over the airwaves and these the programs like Meet the Press and those kind of things, and even the ones on the MSNBC and those kind of things, those kind of stations, they're not having these real conversations. And I'm not saying those people, you've been on those channels, I'm not saying that those people aren't aware, that those people who are having those, leading those conversations aren't bright. They are. You've been on them nationally. But they, certain areas, they just stray away from. They have an opportunity to really make this conversation that you were talking about constantly, making America better, they have an opportunity to be able to do that. Why won't they?
Well, you know, it's not clear. I mean, I think we all, I think this gets into the American subconscious and our culture's subconscious. A lot of foreign affairs and the notion of patriotism is built into our subconscious. It's a leap of faith. America's great, that's one thing, but America, particularly as it stands in foreign policy, is something that we have to get behind as united basis. And you can see now that liberals and conservatives almost compete with one another as to how militant and hawkish they can be about, for instance, the situation in Ukraine. So that instead of maybe doing an evaluation of a foreign policy of America and how did we get here and what is the general situation in the world and a factual analysis of it, we find MSNBC being at least as militant and hawkish as Fox News, and in fact more militant than Fox News. I mean, Fox News has someone like Tucker Carlson who doesn't explain why, but he's cheering for Russia in the conflict without explaining to the world why it might actually make sense to at least have a more sympathetic view to the Russian situation. So I find myself totally reflective, trying to figure things out in retrospect. Why did I think this all along?
Right.
You know, it's sort of like going to a psychologist and suddenly having an epiphany about what it is that's been wrong all this time.
So you see, as you talked about, as we get older and more years behind us than ahead of us, you really start thinking differently, as you stated. You really start saying, have we really been... Have I really been so gullible and naive? Was that me all the time, or is it because our years have gotten shorter that we want to make things better?
Well, I think it might no, because I think there are plenty of people our age who are just as knee-jerk, jingoistic as they always were. I think it might just have to do with the desire to keep learning, and so I think to the extent that more of us would have a desire to get into a state of continual education and learning, try and figure out why, ask the question
right.
Why much more often than maybe we did when we were younger. Why is an important issue, maybe the most important issue to address when we're doing something, and why is a question we don't ask ourselves anywhere near enough when we look at our social issues. Why is there such a problem in central cities? Why are we having these problems internationally? Why does the United States leap into military adventures and leave the world worse rather than better when we exit? You know, why?
Let's do this. Who do we have on the line?
David's calling from California.
Hey, David from California. How you doing, sir? Thank you very much for the call. You say what?
Oh, thanks, Earl. Yeah, I was wondering if your guest was familiar with Naomi Klein and her book about the shock doctrine, where people, and whether they're in politics or in positions of power, intentionally ruin sections of the country so they can buy them up cheap, as Donald Trump got most of his properties because they were declared blighted areas. And so he got a good part of New York City is at a dollar an acre sort of arrangement. And I'm just, you know, hearing you trying to figure out why the political parties are in such turmoil, it really seems like the shock doctrine is at work.
Well, you know, that's connecting dots backwards. And I'm not sure that everything bad that happens is the result of cognitive and purposeful conduct to start with. For instance, redlining. I mean, you can look at the history of redlining, which created the opportunity for wealthy people to buy property cheaply, but it wasn't a policy that was adopted for that reason. It was adopted by lenders and by the organizations that were insuring mortgages.
Separate people.
Who decided that there was a risk to the value of property that was caused by racial mixing and racial influx. So it was invidious, and it was wrong thinking because it was racially based. The people who were doing it thought it was factually based, and it, you know what? They turned out to be right in some respects because there was a white flight that occurred when blacks moved into areas. But the white flight might have been caused by the hysteria and the realization or the self-fulfilling prophecy of what was going on at the time. But that created much of the cheap property, for instance, for people like Donald Trump. And so was it a policy created by government to make the way for wealth making for private equity funds and real estate investors? I think not. But I think it was invidious. So it's just, well, I just don't buy the conspiracy theories that take you all the way to this was willful conduct for the purpose of achieving the outcome that was the result. I think it was willful conduct in many times for purposes that weren't necessarily good purposes, but they weren't the purposes you're describing.
Well, there's a book that was written in the late 1960s. It was, I've forgotten the street address, but it's something on Rose Avenue in New York City, and it was a mob headquarters, and it describes a good part of what you're describing about the New York white flight, that it was organized crime figured out that if they got if they stirred up the bigotry and caused people to flee, then organized crime could actually be involved in the real estate brokerage of inviting blacks into the neighborhood. Then they would only be able to pay rent or pay for a mortgage for two or three months, and then they would evict them and foreclose.
Well, David, I wish we had more time, yeah, man, but thank you very much for the call. Thank you for listening, Sandy.
Well, David's right, actually. I think there is a history of not necessarily organized crime, but shady real estate dealers who participated in trying to create white flight by basically facilitating the movement of blacks in the neighborhoods and then spreading hysteria. That kind of thing did occur, I believe. And I think there is a factual, I think there have been prosecutions, in fact, of criminal prosecutions based on that.
You know, Sandy, I will never get tired of you lifting the IQ of myself and the listening audience. And, man, you just really, you never let me down. It's always something that keeps me thinking. And I'm sure that many in the listening audience feel the same way. So always great to have you on. You'll be back with me on Friday. Thank everybody who made the show go. Thank you, Sam, the son. You won't have to worry about it as much today. See you guys on tomorrow.